Today in Studio 360, it looks human, but changes at night, driven to satisfy monstrous appetites.
I stood, transformed, jaws open, tongue as thick as a baby's arm, breath going up in signals of dreadful life. Moments ago, I hadn't wanted this. Now I wanted nothing else.
I'll talk with Glenn Duncan about what a significant literary novelist does with werewolves.
If a novel was going to succeed with something like a werewolf, it had to deliver what great novels can, which is interiority.
And if werewolves aren't your thing, maybe vampires?
However history remembers me before I was a president, I shall always think of myself as a hunter.
Abraham Lincoln, vampire hunter? That and more is ahead in Studio 360 right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. We're in the middle of our Redesign Canada challenge. I asked you for your six words or less tagline to rebrand Canada for we oblivious Americans, and the slogans just keep pouring in.
Canada, where you can afford food and medicine.
We're Canada, your hippie neighbor.
Canada, our drinking age is lower.
If I was your boyfriend, I'd never let you go. I could take you places you ain't never been before. Baby, take a chance or you'll never ever know. I got money in my hands that I really like to blow.
And we want to hear yours. Submit your slogan to studio360.org and you could win a trip to Washington, D.C. The deadline for our contest is this Sunday. I'll tell you more about that later in the show. But first, you know how they say words have consequences? Well, last week, State Representative Lisa Brown was speaking on the floor of the Michigan House during a debate on legislation that would put new limits on abortions. Here's how she closed her remarks against the bill.
I have not asked you to adopt and adhere to my religious beliefs. Why are you asking me to adopt yours? And finally, Mr. Speaker, I'm flattered that you're all so interested in my vagina, but no means no.
The bill passed the House, but the male Republican Speaker of the House didn't just move on. He banned Lisa Brown from speaking on any bill the next day. Video of that speech went viral, and earlier this week, female officials in Michigan organized a protest at the Capitol in Lansing. They read scenes from the Vagina Monologues, the hugely popular 1998 theater piece by Eve Ensler, who joins me now. Eve Ensler, welcome.
Thank you.
So you were at the protest in Michigan, yeah?
Indeed, I was.
And what was that like?
It was extraordinary. It was truly extraordinary. And I have to say, somebody said they had never seen so many people at the state capitol. I feel it was a really a turnaround moment for not only people in Michigan, but for women across the country.
Let's listen to just a little bit of that rally slash performance from the other day.
First, women were reluctant to talk. They were a little shy. But once they got going, you couldn't stop them. Because women secretly love to talk about their vaginas.
That's Gretchen Whitmer, the leader of the Democratic Caucus of the State Senate in Michigan, reading from the Vagina Monologues. It's one thing to have well-known actors and such people do the Vagina Monologues, as hundreds of them have done over the last decade. But to have essentially the female third of the political establishment in the state of Michigan do it, that's quite something, yeah?
It was fantastic. You know, this year has been an amazing year because in March, nine members of the European Parliament performed the Vagina Monologues inside the European Parliament. And we're really seeing this new trend of women who are in political office doing the show as a way of raising the issue of violence against women, but also as a way of empowerment for themselves and for their constituents. And I think, I don't know, I have a feeling there will be very good things that come out of this. I think there already are.
When Representative Brown had this backlash against her as she uttered the word vagina on the floor of the House. Do you think she got in? She freaked out the people. She freaked out because she said the word vagina, or because she personalized it as my vagina, or because she equated it with rape by saying no means no. What was the provocative part?
Well, it's hard to know because I don't live inside those men, but I would say the chances are good that it had to do with saying the word vagina, but I think that was used as a way to silence her point of view. And I think today there was some big issue that it was equivalent to a time out.
For that little bad girl?
It was time out. So the infantilization of that comment is staggering.
No, it's interesting that earlier this year, when the word vagina suddenly appeared in the news every hour of every day for a while, it was because of this bill proposed on the other side in Virginia about transvaginal probes. I want to play a bit of Amy Poehler doing her bit on SNL about that bill in Virginia.
The Virginia House of Representatives this week passed a bill that required women to have a transvaginal ultrasound before having an abortion. Really? Now, don't get me wrong. I love transvaginal. It's my favorite airline. I got so many miles on transvaginal that I always get upgraded to lady business.
Really? It's strange that these days, it seems perfectly okay to say vagina on television, entertainment news, in the theater, thanks to you, but not in a legislature. Is that just a measure of how politicians, left and right, are always sort of a few steps behind the rest of the culture?
I sometimes call it like the last gasp of patriarchy. You know, it's kind of like, but we know that when dragons have a last gasp, they're actually very dangerous because they give their all to it before they, you know, die out. I think really what we all have to do right now is be very vigilant and very vocal and very even very determined that we will be the people who determine the lives and the futures of our bodies. I've been fighting for the liberation of women since I can remember, and I don't want to be doing this when I'm 85. I want to be living in a new land.
Eve Ensler, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much. I'm very happy to talk to you.
Lust is a subscription, passion's what it's worth. Greed is a conviction, love's a dirty word. It'll bring you down well. Love is a dirty word.
So, what do you think about what happened in the Michigan legislature? Was it just a matter of a word that people found offensive? Or the way Representative Brown posited the whole issue? Let us know at studio360.org. Making a decent living as a serious novelist is not easy. It's never been easy. Rave reviews and showing up on lists of best young writers don't mean that a publisher will earn any money selling your books or that you'll be able to make more than the minimum wage writing them. And that was pretty much how things were going for the British writer Glenn Duncan in his 40s after his 7th well-reviewed novel. Instead of giving up on fiction, though, Duncan made a New Year's resolution to write a book about the last werewolf on Earth, which he did and published last year, and now he's written the sequel, Tallulah Rising, about a single woman who's pregnant, and when the moon is full, she turns into a bloodthirsty monster. Glenn Duncan, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you very much for having me.
So is that actually how it went down, New Year's Eve? Were you drunk? What year, when was it?
It was New Year's Eve, yes, and I was indeed drunk, as was everybody else. And we had done what we do every New Year's Eve, which is to, you know, force down some freezing champagne on the roof terrace and watch the firework display and then come back downstairs and take stock of what we've done in the last 12 months and, rather more worryingly, what we might hope to do in the next 12. And having spent yet another year very, very far from the literary spotlight, when somebody asked me what I was going to do this coming year, in a fit of sort of drunken pique, I said, I'm going to write a novel about the last werewolf on Earth, titled, and this is where creative genius really sidestepped the obvious, The Last Werewolf. And unlike practically any other idea I've ever had for a novel, all my friends sort of feebly agreed that it wasn't a bad idea. So the next morning I woke up and revisited it, and there you go. The last werewolf was born.
In Tallulah Rising and the previous one, you embrace all of the standard received werewolf conventions, the full moon, the silver bullets, the talking to wolves. Did you ever think, oh, I should invent new backstory, or were you happy just to take the givens?
I kept the parts of the mythology that I thought were cool, and ditched the ones that I didn't. So, you know, in some versions, for example, of the werewolf myth, the transformation can be affected at will. That does not leave you with the same moral problem.
Right.
The moral problem's only interesting if it's something that you cannot control. So the full moon transformation exclusively was always going to be part of my version of the werewolf myth.
As it is in modern movies, like An American Werewolf in London from the 1980s, how much did that film play into your thinking as you were writing these books?
That definitely made an impression on me, because chiefly because it took the moral quandary seriously and was very funny and had a believable love story.
David, you're hurting my feelings.
Hurting your feelings? Has it occurred to you that it might be unsettling to see you rise from the grave to visit me?
Now, I'm really sorry to be upsetting you, but I have to warn you.
Warn me?
We were attacked by a werewolf.
I'm not listening to this.
On the moors, we were attacked by a lycanthrope, a werewolf. I was murdered, an unnatural death. And now I walk the earth in limbo until the werewolf's curse is lifted.
Shut up.
The wolf's bloodline must be severed. The last remaining werewolf must be destroyed. It's you, David.
So that's American Werewolf in London, which, when it came out 30 years ago, and it was intended to be this kind of cool, new style werewolf movie. That had an effect on you at the time?
Yeah, very much. I mean, for that mix of ingredients, almost everything that I'd seen before that was played very, very straight. And the idea seemed to be that if you wanted to frighten people, that's all you could do. Or if you wanted to explore another dimension, some supernatural dimension, it was all done with this incredible po-faced literalism. And American Werewolf in London, I thought, really stirred up the mix. It's a very funny film. I still find it a very funny film. Fall in love with Jenny Agutter all over again every single time I see it. And, you know, the two, I suppose, stock genre episodes in that film, the attack at the beginning and the transformation scene, were both, you know, absolutely terrifically handled and creepy and frightening. And I just thought that was a terrific achievement to get all that in and some laughs and a kind of emotional depth. And as I said, to take the moral quandary seriously.
And so when you came to do your own, did you feel that prose fiction, on the other hand, hadn't really advanced and modernized in this realm since, I don't know, Mary Shelley?
You know, I'm not qualified to answer it for the simple reason that outside of the classics, I've not really read any horror fiction. So I don't really know what's going on, or at least what was going on in the commercial end of the market. Uh-huh. But what was apparent to me was that if a novel was going to succeed with something like a werewolf, it had to deliver what great novels can, which is interiority. We're living in a world now where, thanks to CGI technology, there is nothing that cannot be convincingly rendered in the visual field. I mean, we can, you know, we've seen transformation scenes now a million times. We've seen people flying through the air and so on, and it all looks seamlessly convincing. Mm-hmm. But what the movies can't do, of course, is to tell you what that feels like inside while you're going through it.
Well, let's give our listeners a taste of that. Could you read a little bit from Tallulah Rising?
I stood, transformed, jaws open, tongue as thick as a baby's arm, breath going up in signals of dreadful life, half a dozen trees back from the edge of the drive. Moments ago, I hadn't wanted this. Now I wanted nothing else. Same every time. You forgot the curse was an exchange, took your speech and your mercy, but gave you in return the planet's dumb throb and your own share in it. Lilac shadows on the snow, the fine-tuned trees, the Eucharist moon and the victim's heart like a song, calling you home. Caitlin wouldn't see me waiting here. She wouldn't see me until the last moment. But in all the moments before the last moment, she'd know what she didn't want to know. That the worst thing had come to her. The worst thing was a simple thing, an old thing, an ordinary thing. And here it was. She'd look for God, guardian angels, miraculous intervention, and get nothing. Just the trees and the snow and the moon. Nothing from them, either. She'd get the real universe once before the end.
That was Glenn Duncan reading from his new novel, Tallulah Rising. To what extent, if any, is the werewolf a metaphor for you of the true cold-blooded savagery that human beings are capable of?
Well, the central way, I suppose, in which these things function is just that they are a way of looking at the gap between the way we are and the way we want to be. So, I mean, every novel in a way that I've published up until these has been about that. It's been about being at the mercy of desires and drives and, you know, the sort of seductive voice of compromise. The starting point, I suppose, for me was, or at least the moral starting point was, if you said to somebody, right, you're a werewolf, you have to transform into a beast once a month, kill and eat another person, or you will die. The moral reflex, the knee-jerk there, the fairy story, to say, oh, well, I'd kill myself. You know, it's untenable. And yet, you know, I don't think you would.
Yep.
My suspicion is that a large number of people would negotiate it, would accommodate atrocity. And that's, I suppose that's the heart of the metaphor. You know, one of the most alarming things about being human is the speed and ease with which we assimilate atrocity.
And on that cheerful note, I want to thank you very much, Glenn Duncan.
Thank you.
Glenn Duncan's new novel is called Tallulah Rising. And so if you hadn't made that drunken New Year's resolution to write a werewolf book, what would you be doing now?
I'm not sure what I would be doing. Living off my girlfriend, probably, because having been doing this now for the better part of 20 years, I have rendered myself effectively unemployable. I mean, can you see the interview? So, Mr. Duncan, you've been a full-time novelist for the last 20 years. Why do you want to come and work for Topshop? You know?
Yeah.
It's not going to fly, right?
Because I understand people. I'm empathetic to their inner drives and needs.
Yeah. I'm not sure that would convince anyone.
So, werewolves versus vampires, and coming up, vampires versus Abraham Lincoln. Fiction does alternate histories all the time, but this is extreme. Abe Lincoln leading the Union forces against a Confederacy in league with vampires. That's in a minute in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. It's officially summer, which means it's time for Hollywood to roll out a few adaptations of comic books or best-selling novels, some big violent action movies, a supernatural fantasy, and then maybe an historical drama for mom and dad. Wait, why not all four of those things in one movie? Voila, it's Abraham Lincoln, Vampire Hunter.
I presume you know what I can do with this.
Well, I know what you can do against one vampire. But against 20?
The movie, yes, reimagines Abe Lincoln's life and American history as plagued by the blood-sucking undead. And if that's not improbable enough, the director is from the former Soviet Union. Timur Bekmambetov, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you.
So for our listeners who haven't seen the movie yet, help them. Why is our 16th president also a vampire hunter?
You have to ask him why he was. But it's a superhero story. It's a story about the great man who created this country. And we have our own version how it's happened.
Well, what's interesting about it, one of the things that's interesting about it is it's unlike anything else I know about, which is it has this absolutely ridiculous premise, but you take it seriously. You totally embrace its ridiculousness. It's not funny.
No, the joke ends with the title, and the story is very – it's a tragedy. It's a drama, and it's a story – This project helped me to connect with the soul of this country.
Really?
So I'm from Soviet Union, yeah, as you said. And I live here for 7 years and have friends and businesses. And it was still difficult to understand.
Did you know the basic history when you saw this book proposal?
Yeah, of course. We do know. In Russia, we quite... well educated, but still, I knew only a few things. I knew about he freed slaves, and I knew he was a tall guy with a top, with a hat. And
it's about as much as Americans know.
But there was a whole drama about what's happened in the country and how this country was falling apart. And by the way, maybe I never think about it. Maybe the nightmare of the destroying the Soviet Union, it would help me emotionally to connect to this story, because I was born in a country twice bigger than it is now, and it was one family. I understand how important for America was to keep the country united and solid in 19th century, because it's a tragedy when you are losing the solidness of the nation. It's a tragedy culturally, and it's a big deal. And he sacrificed millions of lives to save the country
and
his own life.
And in modern contemporary realistic drama, where we seldom see good versus evil, and of course there are shades of gray in good and evil, but slavery and its abolition and the emancipation of slaves in our history is about as close as you get to clear good versus evil, right?
Slavery is evil. Specifically, like, slavery is a political system, and the slavery is a way how we treat each other. And if we give chance each other to be free and to decide what to do and how to live, that and then it's a different world, and we live in this world.
Are there worries in the movie studio about people will say you're trivializing this most tragic, important part of American history?
We're not trivializing. I think what we do, we created the myth emotionally explaining what's happened in 19th century for young people today, because it's like a myth. It's not telling directly what it is, but telling you emotionally and poetically. And I think it's easy to understand what's happened in 19th century when you are watching our movie than just reading historical book.
History prefers legends to men, soaring speeches to quiet deeds. History remembers the battle and forgets the blood. Whatever history remembers of me, if it remembers anything at all, it shall only be a fraction of the truth.
Did you have any storytelling or movie models, cinematic models for how to do such a strange thing?
Oh, yeah, no. It's such a unique concept, and there was no any precedence. And I'm happy that in the days when every movie is a sequel, prequel, and reboot based on the game and whatever, we made something unique. We made something nobody seen before, there is a movie's influenced me. If you can used two movies. It's one of is Murnau Nosferatu,
the Dracula, Silent Dracula film. Yeah.
And second is W. Griffith Lincoln from 1920. If you can cut them together, it'll be our movie.
Soviet cinema, when you were young, had a very different look and feel, much more European and arty than the movies you're making now. Did you reject that as a young production designer filmmaker? No.
No. It was very arty until Perestroika happened, and I made a lot of commercials and music videos, commercials. And by doing commercials, I found how seducing is to talk to the huge audience, and how to, you know, when you're not doing something for critics or for your friends, when you're in a dialogue with a real audience, and you can, and it's like drugs, you cannot drop.
So we won the Cold War and we corrupted you.
Yes, we did. Yes.
I read that you're working on an adaptation of Moby Dick.
Yes, I do.
Is that going to happen?
I hope so. It's one of the greatest books in all literature. And we have a very good point of view for this book. It's how to make this book contemporary. It sounds contemporary and relatable.
What kinds of things will you do to make it more relatable, other than just having better effects than John Huston could afford back in the 60s?
There is a simple way how to explain. To catch the whale 200 feet long, supernatural scale, you need people with some supernatural abilities.
Aha.
You cannot imagine how you can catch the 200. Can you imagine? We are 6 feet maximum. I'm 5.7 maybe. And it's a 200 feet long animal.
Yeah. Except, spoiler alert, the whale wins. You don't have to catch him.
Yeah, but you have to fight for the 10 minutes of the third act.
And you've also got a movie in the works about Thomas Edison?
I have a great script, yeah. You see, I'm dealing with all-American icons.
Great. All-American icons from the 19th century. What? Why?
Something subliminal. I don't know what's happened. I'm trying. Maybe I'm trying to connect. I'm trying to find the connections with the place where I live now.
Well, I hope you do. And I want to keep watching the results. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Timur Bekmambetov's latest film is Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter, and it's in theaters this weekend. So you could carry that out. I mean, is there some other historical leader you'd like to see fighting supernatural villains? If so, send us your movie title with that unlikely action hero. We're taking your pitches at studio360.org. From the first Lord of the Rings a dozen years ago to all the Harry Potters and Avatar and Prometheus, Hollywood keeps setting higher and higher bars for eye-popping, computerized special effects. But Studio 360's Mark Anderson found out that high-end CGI is also starting to trickle down to indie filmmakers.
As long as there have been independent, low-budget movies, one thing has always set them apart. Indie filmmakers can't afford fancy special effects, so they generally don't make the kinds of movies that need them.
And it's all because of me that we're here now. Hungry, and cold, and hunted.
Even indie films that have crossed over into the mass market, like The Blair Witch Project, have almost made a point of leaving special effects out altogether. But today, just $300 will buy a video game console that unspools the kind of computer graphics that George Lucas or Steven Spielberg would have killed for when they were starting out.
Special effects and CGI allow aspiring filmmakers to kick their stories up a notch and to present them in novel ways or to place them in venues that they didn't used to be.
That's Reed Martin, author of the book The Real Truth, Everything You Didn't Know You Need to Know About Making an Independent Film.
If these newly accessible digital effects can allow filmmakers to tell a story like, say, Dust Boat without having to spend $18 million to build a full-scale submarine mock-up, then that's going to allow more stories to be told, and the movie-going audience will benefit from more interesting stories and more variety in the multiplex today that is marred by endless sequels and repetitions on a theme.
But now filmmakers outside Hollywood can make Hollywood-style movies armed with a good story and a good laptop.
What is this device?
Oh, that's my kick-ass computer.
That is not a computer.
This is a computer.
Oh, this just keeps getting better and better.
That's the trailer for a strange new movie out of Finland called Iron Sky. How strange? Well, it's a satirical sci-fi comedy about space Nazis who established a moon colony in 1945, and now they're on the warpath. And the nations of Earth launch fleets of spaceships to repel them. But the movie is set just 6 years from now. It's as though Mel Brooks was making Spaceballs, but made it look as good as Star Wars.
There's a big silly grin on my face, because not only do they not take themselves so seriously, right? It's a bit of a spoof.
This is Terrence Masson. He wrote CG 101, which is like the special effects Bible in the industry. He's looking at Iron Sky's trailer.
And the actors are great. Forgive me, I don't know the name of the lead actor, but he's just fantastic. And the lead actress isn't bad either. But it's just the production values clearly are incredibly high. Everything from storyboarding through color grading. From what I've seen, it's really, really impressive.
All presidents who start a war in their first term get reelected.
Und fegen alle diese Untermenschen von der Erde.
Get this. Iron Sky was made with just 5% of the budget of Battleship, this summer's other Space Invaders flick. But whether big budget or small, there's always a choke point. The crunch time at the end of a production.
It was 9 years ago now when I was the chief technical officer for Weta Digital. We were working on the final movie in the Lord of the Rings trilogy, The Return of the King.
That's Scott Houston. He's now CEO of Green Button, a computer services company.
There was only 10 weeks to go in the production, and the director, Peter Jackson, had saved his most complex shot for last. It's the scene of Battle of Pelennor Fields, where 14,000 riders of Rohan swoop down the field and do battle with 84,000 orcs. Each one of those characters had to be digitally rendered on the screen, and we needed to actually go out and buy another 1,000 processors right at the last minute of the production to get that one shot done. I realised then, as the IT manager, there needed to be a better way.
The better way he thought about is this. Instead of filmmakers buying their own fleet of computers to run CGI software packages like RenderMan, why not outsource the computing?
So hi, yeah, my name is Chris Ford. I manage the RenderMan business at Pixar Animation Studios, and I initiated the RenderMan On Demand project.
With RenderMan On Demand, you upload a job, say animating 84,000 orcs marching down a field. Then gigantic computer centers located wherever will do the RenderMan processing and return completed CGI shots to the user, for a fee, of course.
I think the real value proposition is time is money. So what's new about this is I think we've made it incredibly easy. We've put a lot of work in the background to make it very easy for an artist to upload their files, literally at the push of a button.
And just to add to what Scott says, it's also really the routine usage of this level of photorealistic visual effects. 5 years ago, you could have looked at a movie and said, that's CG. Now, the quality of the realism is at such a high level, it's actually very hard for anyone except the most trained eye to tell a difference. Sometimes people are looking for the big revolutionary thing. I actually think it's the routine usage of visual effects that is now the big story.
But cloud computing isn't the only way the internet is changing how films will get made. Timo Vorensola, Iron Sky's director, crowdsourced some of the creative work.
What I'm really interested in is actually this kind of a collaborative, community-based cloud.
So for instance, in Iron Sky, every big country on Earth responds to the Nazi invasion by launching their own spacecraft, rockets, shuttles, and souped-up jet fighters. A production designer's dream, or nightmare.
Indian spaceship, for example, and we said that we just don't have enough time or resources to do it, but we really wanted to be one of the ships in the battle. So we turned over to the community and we said, all right, guys, design us the Indian spaceship.
Outside of space operas and battle scenes and explosions, CGI is showing up in all kinds of independent films now. Here's Reed Martin, the film writer.
You can have a film like Iron Sky that was set on the moon. You can have a project that was set in 1940s Los Angeles, where you could never historically afford the costumes, let alone the cars and the set design. So this is really going to broaden the palette. And instead of sort of telling the story of a breakup or the sort of classic 500 Days of Summer, The Girl Who Got Away, filmmakers can tell stories that couldn't be told historically for the budgets that they're working with. And that's a very exciting prospect.
And the downside?
Filmmakers today spend so much time making sure that the pixels are just so, and they really neglect the underlying story that either has to be funny or it has to be compelling because of the plot and storytelling.
A former Pixar animator, William Joyce, working in Shreveport, Louisiana, won an Oscar this year for his animated short called The Fantastic Flying Books of Mr. Morris Lesmore. It uses CGI a little like The Wizard of Oz used color. It's a beautiful movie, and Joyce has put the whole thing up on the web. So CGI doesn't replace the essentials of good filmmaking, but there's a lot of potential here. The world of low-budget films has never seen an opportunity like this to compete with Hollywood on its own turf. For Studio 360, I'm Mark Anderson.
You can see a trailer for Iron Sky, which comes out later this summer, at studio360.org. But coming up now, one of my favorite Canadian musical exports, Bell Orquest. They'll be live here in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. This is Kurt Anderson in Studio 360. If you've got an iPhone, an iPad, or another tablet, I want to make sure you know about some new ways to experience our show. You can find us on Flipboard and on Google Currents, free apps where we've got more stories about great books, music, movies, art, all week long. You may have noticed that we've been yammering an awful lot about Canada lately. And Americans also may not remember that their monarch of their Commonwealth is Queen Elizabeth.
Now, Canada, I want you never to forget that without me, you are nothing. Yes, it's true. I am the only thing that holds you together. Vous êtes encore ensemble. See? French unifying. And without me and the French, you are just Americans. And the Americans, they only want you for one thing. Your body. They don't love you like I love you. I love you.
That is the great Kids in the Hall. For decades, comedians have been shaping the way Americans understand Canada. I'm pretty sure that after oil and lumber, comic actors are the country's leading export. Just off the top of my head, there's Samantha Bee.
We Canadians have the antibodies. I've been biting everyone I can.
Will Arnett.
And it's all because of you, front that all.
Jim Carrey.
Excuse me. I'd like to ask you a few questions.
Mike Myers.
Yeah, baby. Yeah.
Over at Bruce Mao Design, the firm we've hired to rebrand Canada, the team is conducting extensive research into Canadian identity, starting with some funny people, such as Mark McKinney of Kids in the Hall.
And does Canada have a specific sense of humor, and what is it?
I think it was the collision between those of us who grew up on British sketch comedy and a lot more British content, and then sort of translated it into America, married the best of both worlds. American comedy always seemed to me to be more geared towards stand-up, and Brit was more geared towards the group.
Mark McKinney talking with Sarah Felsky, Associate Creative Director at Bruce Mao Design. Next week, the team reveals their shiny new rebranding campaign for Canada, and Gian Gomeshi, the host of Q, the CBC's arts and culture show, returns for a special cross-border quiz. And don't forget, This weekend is your last chance to enter our 6 words or less slogan contest. The best slogan wins a trip to Washington, D.C., and you could also enter Q's contest to try to win a trip to Ottawa. The deadline is Sunday, June 24th at midnight Eastern Time. All the details are at redesigningcanada.com. In addition to comedy, another way Canada has made a big impact here the last few years is in indie rock. Musicians like Broken Social Scene, Feist, and, of course, Arcade Fire. A couple of years ago, 3 members of Arcade Fire decided they wanted to do an instrumental project. So they joined up with 3 other Canadian musicians under the name Bell Orchestre. Their album, As Seen Through Windows, was lush and surprising and one of my favorite albums of the last few years. In 2009, I talked with violinist Sarah Neufeld and bassist Richard Reed Perry about how the band came together.
Originally, me and Sarah and Steph got together through complicated circumstances and scored a piece of contemporary dance when we were in school together in Montreal.
That's Stefan Schneider, who plays drums.
Yeah, that's right.
So this began as a student project.
Yeah. We actually got credits.
Yeah, it was kind of like, can we not take this music class and instead have a weird band that scores for some contemporary dance shows?
And then write like a 1-page report about our show and then get an A?
How cute.
Yeah,
totally. Twas.
Sarah, will you play your song Dark Lights for us?
Okay.
And how did this song come about?
Well, we were rehearsing with some dancers, and we had this rehearsal where we were all kind of switching roles, and the dancers were pushing us around on chairs, and we were improvising, and that's where this song kind of came. It was kind of born in that moment.
Do you ever get tempted to push each other around in chairs or other people as you're playing?
All the time.
Daily.
Well, I'll roll around. Please play Dark Lights. Thank you. That is Bell Orquestre performing Dark Lights from their extremely beautiful new record, As Seen Through Windows. Sarah Neufeld, since my sight line is straight at you, I'm going to ask you to introduce the other members of the orchestre, if you would.
Okay, to my left is Richard Perry on the upright bass, and then there's Stefan Schneider on the drums. And then across from me is Kaveh Nabatian on the trumpet, Colin Stetson on the bass clarinet, Pietro Amato on the French horn, and Michael Fjorstak on the lap steel guitar.
Well done. And the piece Dark Lights was meant to accompany a dance piece.
Yeah.
But so much of your music, all of your music, in my mind, as I hear it, seems like it could accompany a dance, a piece of theater, a film. Do you think of it that way as you make it?
Not really. We just kind of follow our noses musically. But I think definitely like that sensibility and that act of like physically being in the room with dancers, and like we did some short films and some puppet shows and stuff.
Yeah,
kind
all
of just
our,
informed
yeah.
everything from there on after.
And in terms of your audience, it seems like you might be able to fill this niche between people who don't think of themselves as classical music listeners, but then there are people like me who like pop and rock fine, but actually are happy doing without lyrics as well. Is there some new audience that you're speaking to, playing for, do you think?
Hopefully a little bit of everybody.
Yeah. We played a show in Ottawa the other day, and there's this really, really lovely older, like much older woman, like probably in her 80s, I would say, that kind of slowly hobbled into the church because she couldn't make it that night. But really wanted to come and buy the album for her son. She'd heard us on the radio. And
that's
that was like
really,
cool. Yeah, that was really like heartwarming. She was, and we're going back to play there in July. And she was like, oh, I just can't miss you the second time.
But you also get your rock audience?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's pretty, how utopian. are there particular classical, quote unquote, composers who have influenced you?
Yes.
Yeah.
Like?
Like Ervo Pärt.
Steve Reich.
Béla Bartók. I grew up with them.
Really?
Sort of. Like, my mom has a lot of those records. She's a classical flute player, and she always sort of liked the weirder stuff.
And when you're making up this music and you talk about being collaborative and improvising, how does that actually work? With what nubbin of a piece do you begin?
I like that.
Varying degrees of nubbins.
Yeah, sometimes no nubbins. Like, we'll just sit in a room and start to play music. And
hear what each other are doing, react to what each other are doing, and we always record everything we do.
Aha, uh-huh. As you're going, you record. Mm-hmm. So you have your drafts as you go along.
Like, if we had been a band like 100 years ago, we'd be screwed. Somebody would have to be really good at writing.
There's also just, Arcade Fire works within a form, which is popular song, and this band doesn't do that.
This is unpopular song. That form you work in.
This is music from a very unknown place.
Well, I want to thank you both for coming in.
Sure.
The music of Bell Orquest, and you can see a video of their performance here at studio360.org. And that's it for today's show. Thank you very much for listening. We've got more great stuff about music, movies, literature, and art online. You can also find us on Flipboard and Google Currents. And you can follow me on Twitter at KB Anderson. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Jenny Lawton,
Josh Rogerson,
Alana Harper,
Julia Barton,
Krista Ripple,
Mujahid Solomon,
Eve Asher,
Sarah Gook,
Julia Wetherill.
And thanks, as always, to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, we roll out the red and white carpet. The 1st of July is Canada Day.
Yes, you didn't know we had a Canada Day?
I knew.
We have a capital, too, a nation's capital.
And I've been to Ottawa.
That's a good start.
Gian Gomeshi, the host of the CBC's Q, returns to test my knowledge of Canada. Next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.